This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. We all know that it is really tough to start a business, but sometimes tough doesn't begin to describe what it's like to break into the food industry. What does the next great idea look like, and how are tastes changing? And with big companies like Nabisco and Pepsi throwing millions behind ad campaigns for the next hot cracker or cookie or soda, how can the little guy compete? We are joined today by entrepreneurs who have made waves with their new food products. First, we've got Sarah Granulati, founder of Coco Mama, and Jason McRae, founder and CEO of McRae's Candies. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first, I noticed that both of you on your website talk about either all-natural ingredients or organic ingredients. And I wanted to, before we get into the products themselves, there's been controversy recently about what it means to be all natural. And we saw a few weeks ago in the New York Times, Michael Potter, who's the head of Eden Foods, which is a big organic company, say, look, our standards for what is natural and what is organic have really come down. Sarah Granulati from Coco Mama, what are you seeing?
Right. And I agree. It is ambiguous. And, you know, as a consumer, how do you know what you're really getting? You know, I think that that's where, as brands and as companies coming out and as entrepreneurs launching these products, the more transparency, the more conversation we can have with consumers, the better they understand what we mean by natural. I mean, I welcome stricter terms because, you know, that would help us, you know, people can trust right away, oh, they comply because there's rules and they're following them. But, you know, while there's not, the best that we can do is just speak with our consumers. We're using pure maple syrup. We're using organic fair trade quinoa, you know, and talk about what food means to us. And, you know, I think many of the entrepreneurs breaking into the food industry, we're doing it because we see a cultural shift. We see a movement towards knowing our food better. And we're trying to be a part of that mission. And the best thing we can do is just have a conversation with consumers.
Now, is it true that there is no government standard for the label all natural? When you see that in the store, it essentially doesn't mean anything by virtue of what the government says.
Right. There's nothing you have to fill out and send to get approved to be able to say that. That being said, you know, I think you're not going to find many people that are being egregious about it, but there's ways around it that, you know, that's sort of, that used to use the word greenwashing, you know, that happens in food too. And, you know, that's why you need to investigate who's making your food and are they being genuine.
And what kind of things have you seen being counted as natural that you wouldn't consider natural?
I don't know. What I would say is that they tout one or two ingredients that are natural and good, but what you're not realizing, so they're not saying all natural on the front. They might say made with pure whatever, and that's on the front. So then you're thinking, and the picture is very beautiful and, you know, it looks scrumptious. So you're thinking, oh, this must be, you know, made with all whole grains. Well, then inside when you look and it's just a ton of other fillers in addition to those whole grains, you know, label reading is really important.
Jason McRae, do you worry that this sort of this area of natural, of organic has gotten so cloudy that people don't know what they're buying anymore?
I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the things manufacturers are doing and should do is to keep the ingredients short and transparent so that they, you know, when a consumer reads them, they make sense. You know, you can pronounce all the ingredients. I think the consumers are actually pretty sharp and they can tell when there's unusual ingredients on there that maybe they should have, you know, look a little closer at it.
We're also joined on the phone by Nicole Dawes, founder of Late July, which is a snack food company. Nicole, thanks for being here.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I know your dad actually started, not only did you start a company, but your dad actually started Cape Cod Potato Chips, which of course has gone national now. Do you see a difference from when you were growing up and he was working in a food company that really prided itself on being natural, a sort of slipping of the standards in terms of what is natural, what is organic?
Well, that's one of the reasons that Late July only makes the USDA certified organic products, because, you know, as an industry, I feel like we recognize this problem. You know, we saw that customers were losing confidence, they were being confused. And I think one of the most amazing things that our industry has done is they've collectively came together and established the organic standards. Now, given nothing's perfect, and you know we're always working to improve, but by far the USDA certified organic program is the strictest form of food certification that we have in this country, and it's very clearly defined. So if you see a USDA certified organic seal on a product, you know that they've followed a certain set of rules. And you know that's always been my issue with all natural, is it is ambiguous and it is left up to, you know, the integrity and the transparency of the specific company using that language. And you know, for me, I felt more comfortable, and I felt, you know, it's the way it was. I think knowing what I know and having grown up in the business, like to me, that was the standard that I wanted to hold myself to.
Yeah, and we saw actually a lawsuit recently against Nature Valley granola bars, alleging that in fact they were not all natural as claimed.
Well, and I think unfortunately, I mean, you have wonderful companies like Coco Mama, and you have a lot of companies that are doing the right thing. And then you come across companies like that, that are companies, you know, like Frito-Lay calling things all natural that may contain genetic modified ingredients, which is something that, you know, I don't know. I mean, technically it's not against the law, but it's also, you know, what are customers expecting, and, you know, where are you crossing that line? And, you know, that's why using the regulations that are provided by organic do give companies a level playing field. They give you a set of regulations, and also it's a clearly visible set of regulations that consumers can read and understand. They know exactly what they're getting and what they're paying for.
And what do you see in terms of, Sarah Grignotti was talking about the trend that she sees in terms of potentially a generational shift towards more organic natural foods. What are you seeing there? What has made... whether it's gluten-free foods or natural or organic or local, what has made those areas of the market so popular right now?
Well, I actually believe two things have happened. You know, one, I mean, I credit, you know, the Food Network and the, you know, this amazing, wonderful awareness that, like, young people have today about food and how to make it and how it tastes, with a growing excitement over, you know, getting involved and getting to know their food. I think that's been a real game changer for our industry. But second, I think that we have to give a little bit of credit to the industry itself. I mean, my mom had a natural food store in the 70s. I was macrobiotic as a kid. And I mean, full disclosure, you know, my lunch tasted pretty horrible that she would pack me. I mean, it just, you know, the products that were available in the 1970s weren't delicious. They weren't something other people aspired to go home and convince their parents to pack for them. Whereas today, I mean, it's amazing what we've been able to do with, you know, the deliciousness of organic foods. I mean, they're the standard.
So be honest, in the 70s, did you look to trade with other kids?
Oh, I mean, I'll never forget the first time I had a sleepover at someone else's house, and they had, like, you know, I think it was... might have been Lucky Charms or some kind of one of the world's junkiest breakfast cereals. And I came home and I was like, oh, Mom, you're not going to believe what they make. It has marshmallows in it. And you know, and she just explained to me, obviously, why that wasn't good for me. But, you know, the reality was that the products that I had available just didn't taste good. They weren't something that I truly, truly enjoyed. I mean, the home-cooked meals my mom made were excellent, but... you know, the products that you could buy, you know, packaged products in the store just weren't.
Right, right. And I remember those, too. Jason McCray, what are you seeing? Are you seeing, is this a generational shift? Is it a value shift? What's going on in terms of moving people towards natural, organic, local products?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, it sort of feels like it's a pendulum. And, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we had all these great technological advancements with vitamins and all these additives you could add to food and increased farmer productivity and all these things.
Boxed mixes,
right?
Were
and so
great.
It's yeah. Right. So it's not, you know, it's not like an evil thing. I don't believe there's anything horrible happening. But like a lot of trends, I mean, now I think we're swinging the other way, and people are having more of a natural approach. I mean, they're starting to see the impact of that large-scale production and what that can do on their local diet and their local economies and things like that. And I think they're having, in my opinion, a good reaction to it. They're seeking out the local producers and local farmers and maybe farming on their own in their yards and things like this.
And yet, how hard is it as somebody who does sort of small batch local production to break in? Because people are still concerned about money. I mean, there is a bottom line here.
Right. Money's a little bit of a struggle. You have to be obsessed. And, you really have to sing and sing the tune that you're building. I think in my case, I am sort of an obsessive person. And once I latch onto a strong idea, I mean, I just don't let go. And I'll find a way to make it work. But money is tricky. I mean, you can start small and you can go to smaller farmer markets. And Massachusetts has pretty liberal rules on candy and canning, things like that. And you can sort of try the waters before you get, up to a bigger scale. And I always try and encourage people to do that. I mean, I think it's a good idea to get people to make things, whether it's food or anything, to really get their hands dirty. And
you were a chemist. Something. You were a chemist, right, before you got into caramels. How did that happen?
Right. Well, so I have a biology degree with a chemistry minor, and I did chemistry and biology for many years after college, and then sort of gradually segued over to writing database software to crunch huge volumes of bugs or critters or whatever we were collecting. But chemistry is always, I'm a science geek, ultimately. That's what it comes down to, and I love candy. I just my mom has been making candy since I was a little boy and taught me how to make everything. So, when I got laid off from my big high-powered IT job a few years ago, I was just messing around in the kitchen doing what is really just a ton of fun, making little teacher gifts for my kids' teachers, and it just spiraled out of control, really, is what happened.
And what was the first time that you made the first batch intending this to be maybe a commercial product? How did you take the leap from I'm just going to make it for teachers to...
Well, I have to give credit to some of the other entrepreneurs I met along the way and even banks that, because, of course, we have this money problem. And the banks would say, well, why don't you write a business plan? And which I resisted for a long time. And I had a neighbor friend of mine encourage me to write the business plan, which took like a ridiculous amount of time, like 2 months. But when you think it through and you crunch numbers and you think of, well, who are customers that would be interested in something like this? And what did I learn from these first few months of just messing around in my home kitchen? And you have to really have an honest approach and think it through, write it all out, come up with a point of distinction that makes your product different. Why would somebody choose your product over someone else's? And that's, I think, sort of, it didn't really happen overnight. It was really sort of a gradual thing.
Jason McRae, founder and CEO of McRae's Candies, Sarah Granulati, founder of Coco Mama, and Nicole Dawes, founder of Late July. Stand by. We're talking about breaking into the food business with a look at what it takes for a small operation to make it big. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH. I'm Kara Miller. I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and we're talking about what it takes for an entrepreneur to make it big in the food industry, a world that is dominated by big guys like General Mills and Kraft and Coca-Cola. And I'm joined by some entrepreneurs who have broken into the market with their new food products. Sarah Granulati, founder of Coco Mama, Jason McRae, founder and CEO of McRae's Candies, and Nicole Dawes, founder of Late July. And we're also joined on the phone by Stephanie Lawson, an assistant professor of marketing at Suffolk University. And Stephanie, I want to touch on something that Jason mentioned before the break, which is How do you distinguish your product? And I know you've looked at this issue of choice, especially in a place where you have a lot of choices. And in the supermarket in 2010, the average supermarket, so not a mega mart or anything, it carried 38,718 products. How do you set a product apart?
First of all, thanks for having me. You're right. You know, supermarket is a great incubator to actually study consumer choice. With this many items in a store, trying to get a new product like Coco Mama to be, you know, even on the site shelf of a consumer is really hard. And actually, on a personal note, I had heard about the product yesterday, and I went to the store, and of course I saw it for the very first time. So I think our first clue, what we have to think about, is awareness. You know, how do we actually build awareness for consumers in a market that's so overwrought with the number of choices that we have? And one way that you can do that is simply by being on shows like this or doing something with social media. But one of the most dangerous things, I think, for new products is understanding that choice can often paralyze consumers and force them to keep buying the products they've bought in the past.
So, yeah, to talk about that idea of choice, normally we think, you know, if we can have 3 shampoos to choose from, fine. But if we can have 30, that would be great because then we'll find exactly the one that's right for us. But in some ways, choice doesn't quite work that way, does it?
Right. It's actually a paradox. A researcher named Barry Schwartz actually discussed this in a book called Paradox of Choice. And what he found is that, of course, consumers will say, I want as many choices as I can possibly have. I want 500 different lettuces to choose from. But the truth is, once you get into the store and you're trying to make a decision, it's overwhelming. Because oftentimes when we're in the grocery store, we're busy. We have other things to think about. We have price sensitivities. We have someone else with us that needs to get someplace quickly. And so we don't have a lot of time to spend in the store. And so oftentimes we end up making a choice and in the end feel, you know, some type of remorse for purchasing that product or wish that maybe we had tried something else. And so our satisfaction level is actually lower when we have too many choices.
So does that mean that people tend not to try new products because the notion of branching out in a way that they're not used to is, you know, fearful or paralyzing to them? What do we end up doing if we're confronted with 100 choices of cereal?
Well, a couple of different things can happen. One, you can choose to put off the choice. You know, you could just not buy anything and walk away. Two, you can maybe make a choice, but maybe you wouldn't maximize your choice. You're not going to make sure you get the one you would really, really like. You just get the same one you bought before and say, oh, this is just good enough. So you're satisficing instead of maximizing. You know, the other thing is, you know, maybe spend the time. It also depends on consumers' personalities. You know, some consumers are more willing to spend the time to look for the product they really want and kind of suffer through that choice. And then they are very loyal to that product. Whereas other consumers, they use heuristics. You know, this is the cheapest one today. This is the one I had a coupon for. I heard about this product recently, and they'll just get that product and walk out of the store.
Stephanie Lawson, Assistant Professor of Marketing at Suffolk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we've also got here Glenn Kellen, Adjunct Professor of Marketing at Babson, who has worked a lot with the food industry. And talk a little bit about what differentiates the food industry from other industries. Obviously, there's entrepreneurs making all sorts of things. What's more difficult or challenging about trying to get your product in a supermarket?
Yes, it's one key thing. We've been talking about consumer and trying to get consumer demand for the products. And what these young entrepreneurs are facing and new products are facing is that they just don't have the money to do that. There's two sides to the equation here when you're marketing. You have to sell into the trade, and then you have to sell out to the consumer. The issue with the food industry is you've got, as you were saying, you know, you might have 50,000 products in a supermarket, depending on what supermarket chain size and scope. And there's slotting fees. It's a business notorious for,
what is a slotting fee?
Paying for shelf space. And in this day and age, two things have to happen. You have to get the product into the store, which is a very, very, very hard thing for these folks to do. And that's the good news. And then once you're in the store, you got to figure out how to have it move, because if products don't move off the shelves, they're not going to keep it on the shelf. So it's a dual problem. So you've got to get it in. Once you get it in, how are you going to sell it through? And these companies don't have resources to do any advertising. And these are food products. If you have got a good food product, there's one thing you've got to do. You've got to get it in the customer's hand. You got to get it in their mouth. So you have to do a lot of grassroots, a lot of creative ideas, a lot of guerrilla marketing. Sampling is really important, and you can only be so many places. I mean, these companies have 4 people, 10 people, you know, startups, and it's the classic situation where you don't have the resources, you don't have the money, but somehow, some way, you've got to figure out a way to get these wonderful tasting products into someone's hand and ultimately into their mouth. So a lot of in-store sampling, a lot of, you know, people, the woman before said social media. Study just came out the other day. Very few small companies have social media plans. Again, it's another thing that is just on a long list of priorities, and where does it rank on the priority?
You're talking about money. You know, if you're Nabisco and you're rolling out a new, you know, chocolate vanilla marbleized cookie, you can put $100,000, right, in advertising behind that, even though it hasn't launched yet, because you've got a vast reserve of cash.
Right, and they could spend millions. The other thing is their sales force. You know, they've got a lot of people on the ground. These entrepreneurs I'm sitting with here, they're probably out there doing it themselves and with a little bit of help. And the wonderful thing I was saying earlier is that you love to see these success stories, though, because it's very hard to make a product successful with so many products that fail in this industry. But when you get a good product and you can break through and you put the passion behind it, you know, vitamin water, yogurts, you know, you can look at a lot of categories in the food industry where there have been some real success stories. You know, Nantucket Nectar, you know, you look at the woman on the phone, you know, Cape Cod potato chips, Chatham croutons. It's great to get to that point where you break through, but getting there and figuring out creative ideas and ideas that are going to move the brand and move the business is very challenging.
We're talking about food innovation. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. And Nicole Dawes, founder of Late July, let me go to you on that. You saw Cape Cod potato chips and Chatham Foods. You saw those both created and then, of course, sold off. And now you're creating your own business. How difficult is it to get from that great idea to getting it in people's mouths, getting it in the store?
It's very difficult. And, you know, I think one of the things, just listening to the two professors speak, that really resonated with me is how important it is for food entrepreneurs to partner with their retailers, because the reality is most shoppers make their decisions at store level. I mean, I agree, social media is definitely one of the things that's a huge focus for us. But at the end of the day, you know, the shopping and the choice and all those different tortilla chips is one of our main products that they have to choose from. They're making that decision right there in the store. And you know, I guess one of the things I learned, you know, growing up, you know, with my father and just in the 10 years we've been doing Late July, is just your retailer is your best partner. And, you know, I think early on, especially, you know, with Late July, you know, we really partnered with our retailers. We would get in, try to do as many incremental programs as we could, you know, sampling off shelf. You want to increase the number of impressions, the number of times a consumer is going to see your product in that store.
What were the first foods that you were getting in the supermarket or the store and handing out to people? What were those first items that you were trying to launch?
Like me personally? Or
yes, or your people
doing
on your
my
team.
Whole life.
Oh, that's true.
With Late July, we started with a line of crackers, and then we launched cookies, and then just recently we launched chips, tortilla chips. And, you know, the way that you market and the way that you partner with your stores is similar for all three, but, you know, it's a lot easier, I think, to hand out and to sample tortilla chips than it is, say, a cracker. But regardless, that you know, the steps you follow and the things you do with the retailers, it is the same.
Okay.
So with our crackers, you know, we went in, we would partner with, say, Whole Foods. We would take any opportunities we could to get off-shelf, any opportunities we could to partner with their marketing departments to get our products in the hands of their consumers.
And were there big obstacles at first, you know, trying to get people to actually spend the money to buy something that is, I assume, is it a little more expensive than sort of Tostitos?
Well, that's one of the things that I think is very important about organic foods, and that's something we've tried real hard to do at Late July, is to make sure that our foods are always of value. They're not cheap, they're not inexpensive, but that the consumer perceives them to be a value. And, you know, like our tortilla chips are not more expensive than all natural tortilla chips, even though we're organic. We are more expensive than the conventional aisle. But when the consumer is shopping in the all natural aisle, ours are, you know, pretty much the same price as all the other tortillas that they have to choose from. So, you know, we're not asking the consumer to make a big leap of faith with us. We are saying, you know, you can get all the things you're looking for, you know, the non-GMO, organic, good healthy ingredients, and not have to necessarily pay, you know, more for this bag.
And Sarah Granulati, you're in a really interesting space, the gluten-free space. So first of all, talk about how you got into it and then how you tried to bring the product that you created into stores.
So I was lucky that my first job out of college and out of undergrad was in the natural and organic product industry. It's more than just food, the whole industry as a whole, which over the past 15 years has seen tremendous growth even during recession times. So it's been a very exciting business to be in, something that is both personally and professionally a passion. But in 2008, I was diagnosed with some food allergies. And when I had to purchase in a different way, even though I was coming at it from being an industry veteran, I right away saw clear gaps. And there was no nutritious option for people. We were now, you know, if you had to take basically wheat and other gluten grains out of your diet, where were the whole grains? And so it was white rice, corn, tapioca, soy, corn. You know, it just, there wasn't really anything with that value proposition. And it took complaining to a few industry friends for them to kind of turn it on me and say, why don't you do it? And so since then, it's been this goal of coming out with a product line that, you know, represents, there's so many other grains in this world. And as a country, we've become very used to eating the same ingredients. It's, you know, if you look in your cereal aisle, it's wheat, rice, corn and oats. And here I am, I'm coming in and saying, there's quinoa, there's millet, there's amaranth, there's chia, there's all these other grain foods that really anyone can eat and enjoy. So that was the whole inspiration. And
now, let me just stop you for a second. Is it that our cereal aisle is dominated by the grains that you talked about because that's what's inexpensive, that's what's subsidized? I mean, I just wonder if we get into the more exotic grains, are the prices going to go up?
Right. I think it's twofold. I mean, yeah, it is what's inexpensive, and people are used to paying, you know, $2 for a box of cornflakes. Well, all you're getting is corn. You know, you're not getting any kind of protein or high fiber, or you're not getting fruit in that. You're just buying a box of corn. I think, you know, in addition to that, I think that a lot of brands have just made products that they know consumers are comfortable with and know, you know, that easy adoption. But I think we also just as a country are recognizing, and Nicole spoke about this before, With food becoming what, you know, the food network's like the new MTV, you know, we're becoming a more aware society and we're breaking down our barriers and looking beyond what's just here. And so I think that now there are other people realizing, hey, we need to be offering ourselves and we need diversity in our diet. We have a lot of health problems as a nation. And, you know, I think we do need to be looking at the foods that we're eating and making sure we're optimizing.
So you're diagnosed with food allergies, and did you go into your kitchen to create the product that you have now? Was that the first step of just buying things and testing recipes?
Actually, the first step was recognizing the problem and then coming up with the solution, which was there's all these ancient grains that I mentioned, and I'm talking more than just the breakfast aisle, just in general, that I thought you can make a lot of great healthy, versatile foods from, you know, from these grains. So the concept of the brand was ancient grains and whole grain, but also gluten-free products. And then it was deciding what was going to be our first product. And so that was definitely a challenge because I had a few ideas, you know, in the snacking category, in the breakfast category, and bars, you know, and it was really deciding what was going to be best. And so I decided to go a little more innovative with our first product, doing something no one's done before, which has had its pros and cons. But I think one of the pros is, you know, you asked about getting on shelf. And that I think that has helped me get on shelf to where I'm launching right now in 230 stores this month, because the product is quite different. And there's retailers that appreciate that because they know that they're this whole part of this cultural shift of consumers knowing more about their food. They're demanding new and different and looking to try something. So we have a quinoa cereal that's similar to an oatmeal. It's actually already been cooked, and it's in a pouch for you, and it's dairy-free and gluten-free. And, you know, also there's just a lot more people needing gluten-free options, and, you know, it also fills that need for retailers.
What do you see in that space? That's a really interesting space that I think 10 years ago you would have said it, and people would have done a double take. Wait, what?
5 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's going on in the gluten-free space as an insider?
So I think that doctors are becoming a little savvier with recognizing symptoms because, you know, we've used this word ambiguous early on in the show to talk about all natural. Well, you know, symptoms for anyone with gluten issues, they are ambiguous. It's not a very clear cut. And even the diagnosis within issues with gluten, I have an allergy. So I actually have a histamine response when I ingest wheat. But then there's people that have gluten sensitivity, and then there's people with an autoimmune disease called celiac. So there's many reasons people are adopting a wheat-free or a gluten-free diet. In addition, you know, it causes inflammation in the body for anybody. It's just some are more sensitive to it than others. So someone that might have rheumatoid arthritis can see a benefit from cutting wheat out of their diet. So there's just been a growing demand because the consumer base has grown, and it's legitimate. It's not, oh, this is a diet to lose weight. This is really a way of living for medical reasons. And I think that at first, when it was a smaller base, the few companies that were making the products, they didn't need to take too much time to spend on taste. And they were just trying to get products to fill a need, which was very niche at that time. Well, now it's a growing base of consumers who are like, hey, I want my taste. I want my nutrition. I want my convenience. And the demands are there. And now there are more companies and entrepreneurs like me who are trying to meet those needs. And especially, there's a lot that are like me who we eat this way, and so we understand the pain points there.
We're talking about food innovation, and Glenn Kelly from Babson, let me go to you on this issue of gluten-free, organic, which is everybody on the show today, and I didn't even design it this way. You know, markets their products as natural or organic or gluten-free. What's happening in those specialized areas in terms of this explosion of popularity?
Right, and I think what Sarah was saying is a very smart strategy that she decided when she decided to go further out on the product offering, because you have to have a product that has a major point of differentiation when you're a small niche company. And I think there's a great opportunity in this gluten-free area. And if you're real, if you're credible, if you're believable, if you have it, I think, you know, if you look at the numbers, you look at the research, you look at the medical research, this problem is not going away, and it's going to continue to grow in the United States and our society. So I think you're going to see a lot more companies trying to get to this place of, if they're not doing it now, they will be doing it.
Now, when you see companies, whether it's, you talked about Nantucket Nectars, or we talked about Cape Cod potato chips, when they try to scale up and they get bigger, as hopefully, you know, all the companies we're talking to today will, what are the challenges when you get bigger and you're dealing with distributing food all over the place, getting it into different supermarkets, doing it quickly, doing it efficiently? What are the challenges?
Right. Well, there's a long list of challenges. And, you know, people talk about national brands, and what does that really mean? Well, you take a brand like Dunkin' Donuts, which is a great brand. They don't consider themselves national. So if you really step back, you know, what does national mean? I think for these niche brands, if I were running these companies personally, I would focus. And I would try to focus in key areas. The woman mentioned this before with partnering with retailers. And I would, if you're in Whole Foods or you're in some stores like that are right in the wheelhouse where these products should be sold, build that relationship there. And the question strategically is, how much can you sell into that channel versus trying to sell in a lot of different places? Now, eventually, you want to be in a lot of locations. But to start out, I think you really want to focus, because you don't have people, you don't have the sales force. I mean, these people don't have sales forces. You know, the bigger brands, they've got hundreds and thousands of people out there selling. So as you continue to grow, you have to start making decisions. You know, are we going to use a broker? Are we going to use a food broker? Are we going to use an importer? Are we going to use somebody else's sales force? How are we going to get this product out there? And I think they could build these brands to a pretty good revenue base just by staying focused in maybe a geographic area. And I think some brands, when they try to grow, and they try to grow too quickly, they lose their mission, they lose their base, they lose their brand, you know, stance and where they planted the flag. And so there's a whole host of distribution issues and distribution costs and how you're going to get that product out there that that have to be factored in. So, again, it's thinking of creative ways to partner with people, whether it's partnering with a retailer or whether it's partnering with a sales organization. You know, how can you keep those expenses in line because they don't have the revenue and yet, you know, penetrate and legitimately get out there and sell into the marketplace? I mean, this is all about sales and distribution. And a lot of these issues are marketing related to the distribution. And then the reality is, if you look at other categories too, it's interesting. If I were them, I'd be looking at analogies. What other products are out there that are competing with big, big brands? And they don't really compete with those big brands. You know, they're in the same category, but they're not really competing with the big cereal brands. That's an indirect competition, really. But I would look at examples and analogies of companies that have done well when they're very, very small, dealing in a big category. The spirits category, you know, a new spirit brand or an up-and-coming spirit brand competing against Diageo and, you know, Bacardi. Like a Gosling's rum trying to compete with Bacardi. So those are the challenges that you face. And at some point, I think an entrepreneur has to decide, you know, can they get the backing? Can they get the money? Are they making a profit? And then they make a decision, well, you know, I'm going to try to do this alone, or I'm going to partner with people, try to get some investment, or eventually maybe sell the company. And I think most entrepreneurs have it in mind that I'm going to build this, I'm going to get to a certain level, take another look around. Maybe I'll sell it. Maybe I'll keep building it. Maybe I'll partner with somebody. Other strategies that these niche brands can use, and you know, cause marketing is another classic marketing strategy that you know, you can look at. A lot of brands do this. If you do it right, you do it well.
What is cause marketing?
Cause marketing is when you sell your product and you partner with a charity. And so, but again, you've got to be real, you've got to be honest, you've got to be credible, you've got to be believable. I mean, this, you're doing it not self-serving.
Well, and we actually see, I don't know if you would classify this in the same area, but we certainly see like Stonyfield Yogurt or Ben and Jerry's. Those have always been companies that had a social mission.
Absolutely.
At their core, that they were making ice cream, but they were trying to do something else too.
Absolutely. Those are two great examples that you just mentioned. Very successful companies. They were in competitive categories. They were up against big brands. But they always had a culture and a social mission as well. And the other thing is co-branding that I would bring up in terms of if you can find like brands and there's a strategic fit, maybe there's an opportunity to co-brand. You know, they were talking about a retail relationship as a partner. But are there other like products out there, or like brands that are really good brands that fit, that then you can do a co-marketing effort, and it makes sense? And that's a way to do more with less.
Jason McCray, I want to, you know, we've talked about sort of different themes, and I know that one of the themes with the candy company and with your caramels is sort of doing things the way they were done 100 years ago, making candy the way it used to be made instead of the sort of factory way that it is mm-hmm. made now. How important is that as sort of part of telling your story? And do you see that sort of going back to the old-fashioned way of making food as a trend?
I'm not sure if it's a trend, but it seems to fit well for what we're trying to do, and it feels right for us. I always like to think that I take a scientific approach, so I'm sort of combining new flavors, doing interesting, innovative things with the caramel, but ultimately the caramel is an old-fashioned kind of a product. We have a few antique candy wrapping machines that we've restored to help us produce the product, but they're really showstoppers to see them running. And just funny things like that. You know, I guess for me, that's what's really the fun part about it. I mean, we try and have fun, and there's a lot of neat, it's like old school technology to make something that's modern.
And Nicole Dodds, let me direct the last question to you about Late July. You really tried to distinguish yourself in the organic category, which is really tough. And I wonder, this is a category that's increasingly getting crowded. People know that customers are willing to pay more for organic food. When you look ahead, how do you see yourself distinguishing the company from competitors?
Well, I feel that organic is going to represent the future. I mean, I'm building this company for 20, 40 years from today. And I think that if we could have a crystal ball and, look back from there to where we are now, we'll see that the companies like the people on this call today are the companies that are defining kind of who our food business will be moving forward. Because the reality is when you talk to moms and they're shopping, no mom is going to tell you, I want my child food filled with toxic chemicals, pesticides, GMOs, if they have a choice. And the large companies are realizing that, they're waking up to what the consumers are truly asking for. But the companies, like the people on your call today, are the ones that are defining their authentic voice in that world. And we are the ones that are going to redefine who our food business is 20 years from today. So, I mean, to me, the best way to remain competitive and make sure that we stand out in the crowd is to never forget kind of who we are and why we started in the first place. And really continue to be about the mission that we're on and about creating that authentic message that, that trust that I've developed with my consumers so that no matter how big Late July gets, they always know what we stand for. And when they pick up one of our products, they know exactly what they're going to be getting.
We've been talking about innovations in food with a focus on what it takes for an independent business to make it in a world that is typically dominated by big corporations. And I've been speaking with Sarah Granulati, founder of Coco Mama, Jason McRae, founder and CEO of McRae's Candies, and Nicole Dodds, founder of Late July. And we've also been joined by Glenn Kelly, adjunct professor of marketing at Babson. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Callie is back in the studio with me.
Hi, Kara. If you're waiting in line to board a plane, what kind of behavior from a fellow passenger would make you nervous? Would you be thinking maybe he or she could be a terrorist?
Well, I think I would think about sort of behavioral twitches or something, because I know the Israeli government, when they do their profiling, looks at, who's sweating, who seems really nervous. So I think that's what I'd look for.
Okay. Well, we're going to be looking at how the suspicious behavior screening program used at Logan Airport could actually be clouded by unconscious bias, a bias that may be the context behind recent allegations that Boston TSA screening is rife with racial profiling.
Sounds very interesting. I'm Kara Miller.
And I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.